Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bellerín, otro defensor, otro disparo, Monreal, gol. Marca el futbolista español, marca Nacho Monreal. Pim, pam, pum. Pim, pam, pum. Pim, pam, pum. Nacho Monreal. Pim, pam, pum. Nacho Monreal. Nacho.
Is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog, a little bit later than usual on a Monday, but good afternoon to you, James.
Good afternoon to you, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How was your weekend?
Yeah, it was nice. Thanks, man. I've just got back. I was at the seaside in Whitstable in Kent for the weekend, and it was lovely.
Mm.
Sunny.
Seaside. I like it.
Yeah, out of London. Lovely. How was yours?
It was okay. Well, I mean, we've got some amazing weather going on here as well at the moment. It's really, really warm. So I basically sat in the back garden and ended up drinking too much wine to the point where I woke up this morning questioning my will to live. But there you go.
Lucky we did an afternoon podcast, Andrew.
Yes, it certainly
we've done enough questioning our will to live on the podcast recently. We didn't need more of that.
Yeah, look, I came up with a good answer in the end, so it's fine. I'm here and, you know.
It was a positive answer.
just about. But there were moments where I was thinking, nah.
Teetering.
Yeah. But no, it's all good. So, yeah, I'm well and hope everybody out there listening is well and has decompressed a little, I think, given that it's an interlull and there hasn't been a great deal of Arsenal going on. And I think maybe we said this last week, or maybe it was something that we talked about on the Arsecast on Friday. Just, you know, the interlull has come at the right time for everyone, I think. Just to sort of step back, breathe a little, and just, you know, take stock, relax a bit, that's all.
And also, how can you say, Andrew, it's not been a lot of Arsenal news? You're forgetting our 4-0 friendly win over Brentford, of course. The second leg from the opening day of the Premier League, the 4-2 aggregate win now. And star of the show, Cedric Suarez, with a brace.
It feels like an alternative timeline that we've lapsed into, doesn't it? But yeah, look,
I was quite surprised the club even sort of publicised it. Do you know what I mean? Because the replies were so underneath their tweet saying, Arsenal beat Brentford 4-0 was so vicious. I was like, but let's keep those things behind closed doors, in a way.
I get it. Yeah, absolutely. Like the timing of it. I mean, I think it depends on your state of mind when you're reading the tweet that they put out. I think the tweet was fairly innocuous in that it said, we beat Brentford 4-0 in a behind-closed-doors friendly today. I think that's probably as much as it said. But depending on the mood certain people were in, and at that point it wasn't a great mood, it was as if, you know, they had had an open-top bus parade and said, we beat Brentford 4-0 today! We are the best! And, you know, the reactions, I think, you know, I understand why the replies were salty, to say the least.
Salty, to say the least. But listen, Great news. Great to hear Cedric Suarez has finally found his goal scoring boots again as well. I mean, that was some of the Arsenal news around the past week.
Go on, sorry.
Oh, go on. No, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that there was, of course, an actual win for Arsenal women yesterday. 3-2 win over Chelsea to kick off the new Super League campaign. A really big win. First win for the new coach.
At the Emirates Stadium as well.
At the Emirates Stadium. I mean, was that what you were going to mention there?
I did see bits and pieces of that. I was actually going to say that I caught the second half of the England game.
Oh,
yesterday.
Lucky you, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Bukayo Saka, though, getting his birthday goal, which I did enjoy.
That was good. Quite an easy header from a corner, wasn't it? I watched it this morning on the internet. Found an illegal stream of the goal.
Not a guy you associate with scoring headers, I have to say.
Has he scored a couple for us? Or at least one, maybe?
Maybe one. I've got a faint recollection of it. But yeah, he does all right. He does okay on it.
Is there a website which tells you? I mean, there's so many stats out there these days. And I know we can, dig around. But
the Premier League website tells you, if it's a Premier League goal, they divide goals into right foot, left foot and header.
Okay.
But I don't know beyond that. Probably someone, Transfermarkt or someone like that.
They probably do. Anyway, I'm not going to look at it now. But yeah, good for him. And he's 20 now. That's good. 20 is better than 19, I think, personally. From personal experience, I found 20 better than 19.
Yeah, it's interesting on 20. Because they were like, he's not a teenager anymore. But he's not really a grown-up, is he, at 20? So what are we calling him?
But I mean, he can do all the things that an 80-year-old can do and better.
And more, yeah. I imagine.
I mean, he's much more mobile. He can go up and down stairs.
Yeah, maybe he is a grown-up. Maybe I'm patronising him.
I think you are. But inadvertently, I think there comes a point in your life where you realise, hang on a minute, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, well, the grown-ups will fix this. And then something happens at one point in your life and you go, hang on a minute, I'm the fucking grown-up here. I have to do this. That's a terrible realization, I have to say.
I think, I think it's basically defined by when you stop listening to new music. I think there's like a point, like maybe around 30s, or where it's like, oh, I just don't know what the really young people are listening to anymore. Yeah. I'm not speaking for everyone, but
No, of course. I mean, nowadays, I turn the radio on sometimes and it's playing whatever popular music that's on, and I sometimes can only last about 2 seconds. And then there's this moment. Do you ever get this, like, the most delicious silence when a song is on the radio that's really irritating or really annoying and whatever it is, and you push the button on the radio, it turns off, and there's just this, like, silence, which is
impeccable.
It's beautiful. Like, it's
a pristine silence.
Yeah, I love it. I love that.
I think that's when you're a grown-up, basically. That feeling there.
I think so. But look, big shout-out to the Arsenal women. What a big win that was, beating Chelsea, who, as we know, are a terrible, awful bunch of people in whatever format they come in. Men, women, all of them. Apologies to your brother, I know. But still, no mercy.
No, I couldn't agree more.
No mercy whatsoever. For Chelsea, so a great start to the season for them, and brilliant. So that was the good bit of Arsenal news, I suppose, over the weekend. And
and of course a big signing as well for them with Tobin Heath as well.
Yeah, wow, what a team they put together. I might touch on this a bit later on because I think we have a question which might refer to this in a while. But look, we were asked back in May to give our transfer predictions. As we do. And I think it's fair to say, James, that, in the many years we've been doing this podcast, there are things that we are good at and there are things where we're not quite so good.
Correct. Yeah.
And the transfer...
I mean, if I had predicted that you would lose the transfer predictions, then almost every year I would have been right.
It's true. But what I did was I went back to the episode in question and I sort of listened to it again.
Incredible.
I didn't listen
commitment.
To it. Yep. Didn't listen to the whole thing because I was trying to like flick through to the bit where you said your bid and you did your totals and I did my totals. But it's in Arscast Extra 418, I believe, and it starts about an hour and 24 minutes in. And, well, I think it's fair to say we grossly overestimated the amount of money that we would generate through sales.
Yeah, I don't think we're the only ones, to be fair. I think Arsenal Football Club grossly overestimated that as well.
I think so. But we weren't too far away. I mean, we were more ballpark in terms of the money we spent than the money we brought in.
Go on, hit me with it.
So you said we would spend £91 million.
Cheapskates, I thought we'd be.
But generate £83 million.
Yeah.
For a net spend of £8 million. And I said we would spend £100 million, but absolutely ludicrously thought we might bring in £98 million because I was selling fucking everyone. I sold Lacazette, I sold Saliba, yeah. I pretty much sold everyone, I think. Mm. It's a funny discussion, though, because there's some quite funny bits about Martin Odegaard, bringing him back. You said, quite sagely, I think this might be one which might have to let it play out a bit and see what happens.
There you go.
There you go. I said we would sign... You said we wouldn't sign a right back. I said, I think we'll sign someone at right back. I'm not sure who, but I reckon it'll be about £23 million is what I said. I don't know how much the right back cost. Tomiyasu, was it about 20 million, 21 million?
Yeah, 16 plus add-ons. Oh, right, okay. It'll be about 20 in the end.
Okay.
It'll be 20 in the end.
Yeah, 20 in it. Just add on another couple of million and thereabouts.
Yeah.
What was the other one? Yeah, Eddie Nketiah was going out for 17 million.
Of course.
I said I would buy you a prize if we sold Eddie Nketiah for £17 million. So I'm very sorry to tell you that there's no prize for you on that. But yeah, there you go. Those were our predictions. That is how wrong we were. And please let that inform the rest of how you think about everything else that we say on this show.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because, like, you know, clearly the outgoings is kind of the major disappointment, I think, for people in this transfer window. But I sort of don't know how fair it is to criticise it, simply because we all thought much more would be possible than was possible. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's kind of like, you know, we made assumptions that maybe were not fair assumptions about who might be able to move for certain amounts of money. And I'm not just talking about Eddie Nketiah.
I know what you mean. I think if every other club had spent the way we spent, we would have sold more. Yeah. but pretty much nobody else did. We were about the only ones who spent really big. I know Chelsea dished out on Lukaku and... Man City bought Grealish, you know, big individual transfers,
big
but in terms
transfers,
of
yeah.
in terms of bringing in six players and spending £150 million there or thereabouts, there weren't too many other clubs that did that part of it. So I guess, you know, a big part of the transfer market is the way that money circulates when deals start getting done. So one club sells a player, then they've got some money to invest. Sort of like what Aston Villa did. When they knew they were going to sell Grealish to Man City, they basically preemptively spent the Grealish transfer fee on players. Mm. And then when Grealish went, their books were pretty much balanced. Maybe they came out with a little bit of a profit. I don't quite know. But beyond that, there wasn't really... Like Inter Milan weren't going to go and spend the Lukaku money. I mean, that went to whoever was financing their debts or whatever it might be to pay off their debt, so it didn't really happen. I mean, even United paying, what are they paying? £3 million a year for 5 years for Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. It's a weird, weird market. So
yeah, and I think a lot of clubs who wanted to make sales didn't. You know, Man City had a number of first-team players up for sale. They brought in £24 million in the end. Man United, 25. Liverpool did a bit better, 38. The big outlier are Chelsea, who somehow managed to bring in £135 million this summer in transfer fees. They are kind of the master exponents of this, I think.
How
in terms
the
of,
fuck did they do
that? I mean, let's try and break that down. I'm just reading that off a chart that we had on The Athletic. But let's see, transfer history, Chelsea. I mean, obviously, they are sort of... As I say, great exponents of sending players out on loan and then cashing in on them. So this summer, £36 million for Tammy Abraham, £31 million for Kurt Zouma, 26 for Fikayo Tomori. There was 18 million, I think, wasn't there for the boy who went to Palace, the centre half.
What's his name? Oh, yeah, yeah. Thingy. What's his face? Jokimajig.
Jokimajig.
John Jokimajig, yeah. He's doing well at Palace, I believe.
Mark Guehi, that's his
name. That's the fella, John, yeah.
There are others, even someone like Zappa Costa, they got like 8, 10 million quid for him.
That's insane. How are they getting like 10 million for Zappa Costa and we can't get Tuppence Halfpenny for Hector Bellerin? How is that possible? So, I know what you're saying. Yeah. I do know what you're saying about... about the sales and all that kind of stuff. But some of those Chelsea deals, they make a lie of the difficult market situation. Or certainly, it is a difficult market. We understand. We all know it was a difficult market. But it still shows that if you've got really good sellers, good salesmen, maybe that's what we need. We've joked about this before, that we need a head of sales. I think we do.
See, I think it's much more about what Chelsea have done to make those players valuable. So, say someone like Tammy Abraham, if you look at the loan spells that he had early in his career with, I think, Bristol, Aston Villa, they were incredibly productive and sort of provided a kind of track record that gives him, I think, a certain prestige and value on the transfer market. Mm. Eddie Nketiah has had, 6 months at Leeds in which he didn't start. And that's sort of basically it in terms of like regular first team football. I think the skill of Chelsea is that they station these players, at clubs where they accumulate experience, accumulate value, and then they feel like less of a risk for a buying club. Like Kurt Zouma is a great example. So he's actually 26 now. He went for 30 million quid. But since he joined Chelsea, he's had a loan back at St Etienne, that old trick that, we've seen used many times. Stoke City spent a season on loan. Everton spent a season on loan and then played plenty of games for Chelsea too. I do think that that's just created a kind of value in these players that we've failed to do. And we look at the guys and we go, well, everyone knows Reece Nelson and Ketty are talented, so turn up with 15 million quid, please, or whatever it might be. But until they've proven it at senior level, clubs are going to be wary of taking that gamble.
So why don't we fucking just loan them out then?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think that's the error. Do you know what I mean? I think that's where we get it wrong. I think that we don't do the most to make players valuable while they're on our books.
And not just young players either, in fairness. There are some...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That idea of kind of tanking a player's value. I think that that's... I don't know how much this is down to sort of the negotiations, because ultimately buying clubs have a kind of budget and they have the value of a player that they... I mean, I think you could make the case, should Arsenal have accepted offers that were on the table for people like Nketiah? We know Palace went to 12 million. I've seen some stuff about maybe personal terms issue there.
So accept the offer, so...
Yeah, who knows? I'm not sure. I'm sure some people know. I don't actually know on that one. But if... But there are other cases like Xhaka, for example, where the money wasn't what we thought was right or what Edu and Arteta thought was right, and so the deal doesn't happen. So you can have the debate of, like, should we have taken what was on the table? But I also think, I think we just need to do more to make sure that these players kind of grow in equity in the time that we have them, because it just feels like within the club or within the fans, we're like, oh yeah, that guy's talented. But then by the time the market comes around, he's done nothing for 6 months and no one outside the club is going to put that kind of value on him.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And Chelsea, like I say, they're very skillful at doing that. And they do have a huge, huge first team squad and they have trimmed it substantially this summer. But yeah, if you look through the Premier League, they are... This summer, they were the ones. I mean, they ended the summer, I think, plus 37 million on transfer window.
And I mean, Zouma is the guy who got absolutely turned inside out by Aubameyang in the cup final.
Mm.
Wasn't it? Yeah, because there was that great clip because it was there were no fans in the stadium that day. They had one of those like behind the goal cameras. I can't remember which Chelsea player it was, but as Aubameyang went past him, you just hear him go, "Oh, zoo," like that, like, "Oh no, oh zoo." I can't remember which one, but it's a very, very, very funny moment, obviously, because Aubameyang then went and scored the goals. So, I mean, even with that, he's gone for 30-odd million to West Ham, so...
Yeah, I mean... So, yeah, I mean, Arsenal brought in, what, the 22 million for Joe Willock this summer.
10 million down the line for Guendouzi.
Yeah, in fairness, I do keep forgetting the Guendouzi and Mavropanos ones, you know.
Mavropanos is only a couple of million as well.
4 million or something like that, yeah. So what does that take us up to? About 35. So roughly equivalent to what Liverpool brought in, but nothing like what we... hoped for. And it's interesting the cases where it feels like the club's taken a bit of a gamble that they might be able to get something better down the line. I mean, look at Reece Nelson, gone out on loan but with a 1-year extension on his contract.
Xhaka.
Maybe they're hoping they will.
Do you think they're hoping that with regard to Xhaka, or do you think that they made commitment to keeping Xhaka? Like, it's not... The extension wasn't done with the express purpose of, in inverted commas, protecting his value. It was done because they just wanted him to stay, which is, you know, an increasingly depressing thought to me. But there you go.
I think if there was an appropriate offer on the table next summer, I think they'd consider it. I think what's certain is that they will have to address that area, you know, next summer. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? After this very busy window. I mean, there was a number flying around from Arsenal about something like 19 first team deals involving if you include new contracts, transfers in, transfers out, loans out. It's quite clear sort of where Arsenal will be looking in the forthcoming transfer windows. You know, I think central midfield is going to be one, centre forward, I think almost certainly is going to be one, and potentially some sort of goalkeeper. I think.
Well, look, you've sort of brought it around more or less to the Edu interview over the weekend.
The Edu media blitz, yes.
Yeah, yes, the Edu extravaganza. Yeah. It's all Edu all the time. Yeah. what did you make of the interview? Were you surprised in any way that there was an interview with Edu, who is a technical director? I know on the Arsecast on Friday, David Ornstein referenced a couple of technical directors across Europe who are a bit more front and center when it comes to the media. They might hold their own press conferences. And, you know, I think it's a cultural thing maybe that these roles at other clubs in other countries are a bit more public facing than they might be in England. I mean, I know it's not a brand new thing, but certainly the technical director side of things is still relatively new in England. You know, the culture in England has always been the manager is the man, he is the guy who's answerable to everything. But of course, the organisations have changed and the way they're set up, etc., has changed over the years. So were you surprised that we heard from Edu?
I was a little bit pleasantly surprised, to be honest. Because I know that Arsenal had considered kind of communicating their strategy earlier in the summer and ultimately decided to just let what they were let their actions do the talking. And I think their actions did do the talking, really. I mean, I don't think it took a genius to kind of figure out what the strategy was this summer. And it was widely reported, and David spoke about it at length on your show. I was a little bit pleasantly surprised. I think Edu has done it in the past off the back of windows. I seem to recall maybe this time a year ago, you know, after all the uncertainty that had gone on with Raul Sinyei and then the late St. Thomas Partey, I think he did an interview around that time too. So maybe it's something we'll see from him, you know, that he'll address these things after the window is done. I wonder as well, if there is some sensitivity within the club about how much criticism Edu was receiving, which was pretty substantial, I'm sure you'll agree, online and among the fan base. He was coming under
fire.
I hadn't noticed. Hadn't noticed anything about a barbecue or anything, or being on a boat. Fair enough.
News. You can tell me offline after.
So I think they were keen to kind of make it clear that while he was at the grill, he was still on the grid, shall we say, throughout the summer. Yeah. And I think... I think it's good. I do think that this kind of communication is important. I think that I don't think it told fans, or certainly quite engaged fans, anything they didn't especially know. I think we could all kind of figure this out for ourselves. But having someone being prepared to be the front man of that and kind of wear it publicly, I think is good. Do you?
Yeah, I was happy to see it. I think more communication... I think the better a club can communicate its ideas, particularly when things are going wrong, the better. You know, I think it's a good skill to have. It's a good thing to be able to communicate directly with fans. I know this was done with Sky Sports, but I think even that was probably, you know, quite... they could have done it through the official website. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and they easily did sat some down. Stuff, I think, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so. But, like, you know, when it is an outside organisation... you know, you can't necessarily be accused. Like, he could have given the same answers to an interviewer from Arsenal.com, same questions, et cetera, et cetera. And just by virtue of the fact that it would be on the official website, people could dismiss it as propaganda or, you know, this is Pravda, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they had to do it with an external outlet. I think I would have liked him to be pressed a little bit more on certain aspects of it, because I think you're right. The stuff about the incoming strategy is pretty clear. You know, we could all see...
It's kind of self-explanatory,
isn't it? Yeah, it's self-explanatory. You know, we know that you've been targeting younger players. We know that we've got a, you know, some existing good young players at the club around which to build. But I think I would have liked maybe just a little more on, you know, the outgoing business not being as good as we would have liked. I think... You know, he could have been drilled a little bit harder than that. And I think also some of the stuff that I think it's difficult for Edu to, at this point anyway, distance himself from some of the issues that we have when it comes to selling players, because he was at the club. He was technical director. You know, when certain players were brought in, transfer deals didn't work. You know, it's like he's sort of pivoted to this one without... I'm not saying he's abdicated himself of responsibility, but I do think, you know, some questions around that might have been more challenging for him to answer, and I think maybe could have provided a little more insight. But,
I think that's fair. I think, personally, I felt like there was a little bit of sort of retconning going on, especially when he spoke about, you know, we started implementing this strategy last summer. Because I have to be honest, when I look at last summer's business, it's so different.
Well, it's to what exactly. It's Thomas Partey was 27, Willian was 56, and Gabriel, of course, was a young player who was 22 or whatever. So that was it in terms of our incoming. We brought in Alex Runison, but let's never speak of that again. You know, so yeah, it doesn't really add up unless they sort of went, oh, bollocks, a year ago. I think it's probably just something that you say to make it sound like that's what you were doing a year ago when everyone can see it wasn't.
Yeah, I think they were sort of coming round to this way of thinking by the time January rolled around and they, you know, paid a lot of players off and brought Martin Odegaard in on loan. But last summer, and in fairness, it was a very chaotic, destabilised summer for lots of different reasons. I don't think they were already kind of on this path.
Yeah.
So you know, I understand the temptation to kind of retcon that, but sure. I do think that this does feel like a more recent change of direction. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it when it's laid out for you in the way that Edu did? Are you on board with
it as a strategy? Well, I think we said this last week on the show that, like, we were talking about the strategy and we were talking about the incoming business. And while it's still too early to say if these transfers are going to be good or successful, I think we both said, despite, you know, the kind of high dudgeon we found ourselves in on last week's show because of the Man City defeat and, you know, things were still a bit raw at that point, what we both made clear was that, like, in terms of a strategy, we liked it. We were on board with that. We can see that that's a way of operating which is different from what we've done in the past. We can't keep repeating the same mistakes. So maybe these will be just different mistakes, but ideally it will be a success. And I think what I like is it's coherent. You know, it's coherent. It's not necessarily manager specific. It can grow and develop under the next manager or the next manager. You know what I mean? So these young players, growing this group of young players together, I like it. I'm on board. You know, it's one of those things, I think, as a football fan, this idea of a young group of players coming together to become, you know, all-conquering heroes is quite a romantic one. I get as well that it's quite a far-fetched one. But as a thing to sort of believe in, it's there. Where I had a little bit of doubt was when he talked about the experienced players that we need to help these young players realize their potential. And he name-checked five of them. And it wasn't convincing to me because there are issues with those players. So Alex Lacazette.
So who are the five?
Well, he mentioned Lacazette, Xhaka, Aubameyang, Partey, and Bernd Leno. So Bernd Leno has just seen the club spend £24 million on a goalkeeper who, you know, he knows, we know, they know, everyone knows, is going to replace him because that's the only reason you spend £24 million on a goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. Lacazette's in the last year of his contract. I'm not saying that he can't and won't be a good role model to the young players and, you know, on the training ground, et cetera, et cetera. But he's not here for the long haul. He's probably going to go next summer, as is Leno. Xhaka, he's just too much Xhaka. He's exasperating. I just, you know, the last few weeks have really... Yeah, look, I just... I know we could have a big, big discussion about leadership and what have you, but, you know, if he is the kind of leader that you're looking for in the dressing room, I have some worries. That's all. Mm-hmm. Just I have some worries about that. Mm-hmm. And Aubameyang...
And also, let's say in that discussion as well, there was the potential that he was going to leave the club this summer.
Yeah.
It's not beyond the realms. Possibly he will leave the club in the nearish future too.
Yeah.
It is not exactly a kind of unshakable pillar at the heart of the club.
Correct. Who else? Aubameyang, look, I think a really popular guy in the dressing room. I don't think he's necessarily a natural captain, but I do think he understands the role and the profile and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, at the same time, he's 32. Or, you know, so he's towards the end of his career. Thomas Partey, 28, the right age, you know, for a player in this kind of setup to be one of the, you know, the foundations, the cornerstones of it. Absolutely. But, and I think he can do it. I think he really can do it, but he's got to stay fit. And, you know, that's not a criticism of him because I don't think he can do anything about the kind of tackle that put him out for the few weeks that he's been out in that game against Chelsea. That's not being injury prone. That's not being weak or not looking after yourself or not being fit for whatever reason. You know, it's just an unfortunate thing. But nevertheless, injury issues have been a thing. So when you're the good part of your plan is... I'm not going to say fully dependent, but by Edu's own admission, it is quite dependent on the guidance that these guys can bring to these young players.
Mm.
That's where I find it sort of falls down a little for me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I wonder, I mean, obviously, you know, they know the situation surrounding those players. I'd wonder, is this just sort of a way of slightly throwing the gauntlet down to them and also just kind of describing the strategy in a way that still makes these big, influential players in the dressing room, at least, feel part of things? I mean, if you come out there and say, listen, we're about the youth, we want to have a young squad, blah, blah, blah. You know, do you end up making someone like Leno, who's already seen what's happened with Aaron Ramsdale coming in and probably knows what that means for his future, end up feeling very disconnected very quickly? Is this a way of kind of trying to anchor these guys, or tie them rather, sort of to the project and make them feel part of it? I wonder if that might be what they're thinking.
Yeah, maybe.
Because the question marks are so obvious, you know, and we all see them. And I think separate to that, I do have another concern, which is obviously, like, it's great to have a young squad. And, you know, there have been squads full of young players in the Premier League that have gone on and done great things. But it has always been dependent on, you know, several guiding lights, senior players who, you know, were the right kinds of leaders for those young players. And I think it's fair to say that right now it's difficult to have confidence that we have those. And so that puts an awful lot of onus and responsibility on a very young group.
Yeah, I think the other thing to mention as well is that there's a sort of mid-level group of players as well.
Yeah, how do they feel? Because they don't even get a mention.
We're not young. We're not elder statesmen, but we're still pretty experienced. So you think of...
Where was Cedric Suarez in the five pillars?
Exactly, Rob.
It's almost as if that brace in a behind-closed-doors friendly against Brentford didn't even happen.
Jesus. But I mean, Cedric, Pablo Marie... Rob Holding, Callum Chambers. I mean, he's still here and likely to be here. El Neni, exactly. So I think those are another aspect of it where, look, every squad has got its workman-like players.
Yeah.
You just can't, unless you're one of the super, super rich clubs. And even then, they carry some sort of, not dead weight, but, you know, there's a... There are players who are just not as good, but we have a bit more than most clubs right now. So I do wonder what they're thinking.
The in-betweeners.
The in-betweeners.
That's who they are.
Football friends.
Yeah, it is odd. I mean, they're conspicuous by their absence. I can see why Edu wouldn't cite Cedric or Pablo Marie, you know, in a public space right now. They're not exactly fan favourites from where I'm stood, but... Mm. Yeah, they are kind of sort of in no man's land, really, between these two groups. Listen, I mean, if there's one thing we know, it's that not all these kids are going to make it, are going to be the great players they hope. We've been here before, haven't we? We've seen really promising groups of players, and maybe it's a few that actually deliver against that potential. I don't think we can anticipate that, you know, Sambi definitely becomes Arsenal's central midfielder and Tomiyasu is a revelation at right back and Ramsdale's number one. I just think the chances of them all coming off are slim. So I think there is going to be pressure and responsibility on the other parts of the squad, the older age groups, and they do need to deliver. It was interesting as well hearing Edu kind of talk about, or not talk about, timelines, really. You know, he kind of was pushed on what's the aim for this season. He really didn't want to attach or something specific to that for obvious reasons. You know, if they set something out publicly, they will fall short. But you did get the sense of this being a more midterm than short-term project, certainly, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And that's a difficult question, like, you know, about where we're going to finish.
Season.
But I did quite enjoy the messaging that came from the new Arsenal women coach yesterday, Jonas Eidevall, when he talked about, we are a big club. And he, you know, he made that assertion, you know, knowing that he's got some tough teams to beat in the league this season if he wants Arsenal to be champions. And I just wonder if maybe there was an opportunity missed there to just sort of try and galvanize people a little. You know, I know you can't say, well, we're definitely going to finish sixth this year. We're definitely going to finish fifth this year. And, you know, you can't get excited about that. Like, if he said, we're going to finish fifth this year and we didn't, he's going to get hammered. And if he does say it, people are going to go, well, so what? I mean, yeah, it's progress, but, you know, you can't be crowing about finishing fifth. So it is a difficult one. But I just wonder if there was an opportunity missed just to try and bring everybody around. I think that's what he tried to do. And obviously, you know, speaking out the way that he spoke out and everything else, I think it was an attempt to try and placate some of the shitstorm that's been going on because of the start to the season.
Yeah, and I think he could only do this interview really in a gap without games, to be honest. I think it almost required things to settle slightly for him to come out and speak in this way. And I do wonder if maybe not, you know, if he had said we're a big club and we're sat in 20th place, like, does it open him up to derision as much as anything else? I don't know. But yeah, well, it's always good, I think, to hear from people who are, you know, ultimately the decision makers at the club and get some sense of where we're going. It just, you know, a phrase we use on this podcast quite habitually is the proof will be in the pudding. And that kind of never feels truer, really, than with the recruitment that the club has done this summer, because they're all sort of bets, aren't they? They're all bets on potential, rather than a Thomas Partey and Aubameyang kind of a proven, you know, oven-ready talent. So, yeah, we'll have to kind of wait and see. And I'm fascinated to see how many of those signings squeeze into the team for the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we said last week, isn't it? When, you know, when the team runs out against Norwich, I know there's an enforced absence in Xhaka because he can't play. So that obviously, hopefully, will mean a place for Sambi if Thomas Partey is fit again. But, like, how much, I'm not saying it's easier for people to get behind the team, but how much more exciting would it be if you've got a new guy in goal, if you've got a new centre half, you've got the other relatively new centre half back in alongside him, you've got a new right back, you've got Tierney, you've got Sambi, you've got Martin Odegaard in the team, you know, you've got your exciting guys in Saka, Smith Rowe, Pepe, Aubameyang, etc., etc. I feel like that is a team that people would definitely feel good about getting behind, and hopefully a team that can produce the kind of performance that we need against Norwich. So,
and Edu did say, I think, you know, I want to see the team, and we've not seen it yet.
Well,
and
that's
correct. So, it'd be very interesting to see. I think certainly in the defence, you know, a lot of those new names are going to be involved, and I'm really hoping that Norwich provides a bit of kind of catharsis and relief.
You know, some goals and shit. That would be good. Okay, well, look, I think we have some sort of associated questions with the Edu interview. So we'll take a little break here, as we always do, and we will come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer the questions that you sent to us on Twitter at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. We've got some stuff coming on Patreon this week as well. On Wednesday, I think we're going to do an episode of Waffle in which James and I talk about anything and everything apart from Arsenal and football. We take your questions and suggestions on Patreon, on the Discord as well. So feel free to join us for that. Patreon.com/Arsblog. James, it's absolutely roasting in my office.
Is it?
Roasting. Because the sun is shining right through the window here, so I'm having to let the blind out.
Like a magnifying glass.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Like I'm some kind of podcasting ant to the mean god of the sun.
Absolutely.
But I'm not complaining. I love hot weather, so there you go. What was I going to say? There was something else. Never mind. I'll come back to it. I'll remember it, or I won't. Okay. So if I don't, nobody will know the difference. Here's a question from Andre Benjamin, who's at Dope Gooner. Apparently he's really good. He says, how do you think Arteta feels about Edu's Sky Sports interview? A lot of what our technical director said to Jeff Shreve seemed to indicate that it's now in the hands of the manager. Did Edu throw Arteta under the bus, or was he just stating facts?
I think there's a bit of sort of positioning going on, certainly, on Edu's part. And I think as well, on the part of the club, I mean, since Arteta got that promotion to being manager, there has been a sort of vagueness about the hierarchy and the process and the structure, certainly on the outside of the club, you know, who's doing what, who's in charge, who's running this show. And I think part of the public interview was a sort of Edu, you know, kind of not throwing his weight around, but sort of, you know, trying to demonstrate what he brings to the party. And I think, yeah, look, if your technical director's out there saying, I'm looking forward to seeing this team come together, we've really supported the manager, all those kinds of, you know, ding-ding-ding phrases, then it does throw a certain spotlight on Arteta. But I wouldn't call that throwing him under the bus. I would just call that the reality of the situation. I mean, the manager, the head coach, whatever you want to call him, sooner or later has to get results. You know, whatever, anything Edu says doesn't massively change that. I didn't get the sense from Edu that, you know, they're trying to distance him from Arteta or create a sense. You know, it wasn't the kind of dreaded vote of confidence kind of thing. But you know, the pressure is real because they need some wins. What do you think?
I think you're spot on there, yeah. I mean, David sort of described Edu and Arteta as a two-headed beast the other day, and I think that's true. I don't know, you know, what you say about there being positioning, I think is right, but I don't know that there's quite the still the distance or whatever that there would be at other clubs between the technical director and the manager. But yeah, look, the reality is, and we've said this, Arteta has been backed in the transfer market more than any other manager in the Premier League. In fact, probably more than any other manager in Europe this summer in terms of what was spent. So with that comes pressure. And the reality is, for a club like Arsenal, you've got to start producing. You've got to start delivering in terms of results and performances. So there's only so much the club can do during a transfer window to give a manager what he wants. And after that, he's kind of flying solo, if you know what I mean.
And I think you have to give the club some credit for proceeding with the incoming plans despite the failure to do the outgoing business that was hoped for. You know, they've still, we thought they'd bring in, and maybe they thought they'd bring in £100 million in sales to pay for this rebuild. Yeah. They haven't done it, but they have at least still supported the manager and got him half a dozen new players. And, you know, I mean, in a lot of cases, it's Mikel Arteta's final say-so on who those players are. So, you know, inevitably, it places a bit of a spotlight on him.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I do think as well that the, as much as there's pressure on Arteta, there is pressure on Edu too. For all the justifications and the rationalizations and the seeking to understand that we have done with regards the outgoing business, I reckon there was an expectation that we were going to bring in more than we did. And when you're in the position where that is your remit, then I think that comes with some pressure too. So, they both have to do it, you know?
They do, yeah, yeah. And I think, was it on the Arsecast that David said, you know, in theory, if Arteta was to go, Edu would be the man to lead the search for his replacement? Was that on the Arsecast?
Could have been, I can't remember.
Either way, you know, that's right, that's correct within the hierarchy of the club. But like you, I feel that because there's such overlap between these roles, I don't know how clean that would ultimately be. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if one fell, the other might fall with them. That if you're a two-headed beast and one of the heads gets chopped off, it's probably quite unlikely the beast survives. I wonder if... it's hard without one of your heads.
Without one of your heads.
You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of bleeding in that scenario.
A lot of gushing going on there, you know.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, we're not at that point yet. But I think the pressure is on Arteta. And, you know, a home game against Norwich few games into the season is not characteristically one that you would associate with being a high-pressure occasion. But I think in this instance, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
Shall we have another question?
Let's.
Okay. There's lots of questions. What about this from Ish Mohammed, who's at Imo1990 on Twitter? And Ish says, quite happy with our right-back signing, but isn't there something uncomfortable about one of the pros of the signing being the fact that he can cover the supposed... Oh, pardon me, I just did a burp. cover the supposed defending deficiencies of the £50 million centre-back we just bought?
But, I mean, is that a real thing? Is that a real thing, or is that just something that someone on Twitter said?
Yeah.
Like, is that...
I don't think the club are thinking of it in that way. No, I don't think they're thinking, we better buy a good right-back because Ben White's absolutely shit.
Yeah, yeah. Mikel Arteta said, I'm very happy to sign this right-back. He gives us something that, you know, we clearly lack and that our new £50 million signing just can't do. So, you know, it's great that we've got him in. I think what's happened is Ben White had a difficult game in the air against Brentford. It wasn't as bad as it was made out. I think he won 3 of 7. And my recollection of watching it was that it was worse than it was. But when I went back to look at it again and look at the challenges and look at the stats, you know, he was out-jumped a few times and it didn't look good, but he did win some headers as well. I'm trying to remember where I'm going with this. I've completely lost my train of thought. I mean, the Tomiyasu is really good in the air. His aerial stats are kind of off the charts. So I just wonder if people have looked at that, looked at what happened to Ben White in his first game as an Arsenal player and put 2 and 2 together and, you know, come up with 5 a little bit. I think.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. We spent a lot of money on Ben White, and like you say, we haven't seen a lot of him so far. And what we've seen wasn't especially convincing against Brentford. If I look at the signings and I sort of try and evaluate them all individually, and I think about you know, how they fit into the team, how they fit into the project. What Edu said about Ben White was interesting, wasn't it? He said something like, you know, between us, Mikel and I decided that we needed to really put a lot of emphasis on the centre-back position because we were losing David Luiz and we needed someone to replace them. My only sort of worry with Ben White as a signing is just when I look at that defence, you know, we know it's almost certainly going to be Tierney, Gabriel, because Pablo Marie looks nowhere near it at the moment, Ben White, Tomiyasu. It is a defence that is very young. You know, there's experience in all those players. A lot of them have played an awful lot of senior football already. But, you know, are any of them the guy to kind of marshal that back line? And that's my only kind of worry when I look at those names and look at how they've pieced together. Yeah. You know, when you talk about having the five players or whatever, the senior pros who you want to build around, I kind of wouldn't mind one of them being a centre-half.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. But look, we've said before that when there's a gap, when people who are in leadership roles, and whether you liked him or you didn't like him, David Luiz was certainly that. He was certainly that kind of character, you know, on the pitch and in the training ground. Whether you think his constant red cards and penalties is a great example to be setting anyway is a different question. But I think just in general, in terms of personality. But we're looking for people to step up. We're looking for characters to emerge and for those people to take responsibility. So whether it is Ben White or whether it's Kieran Tierney becomes a bit more vocal back there, well, that'd be hard considering he's never really there. You know, Gabriel doesn't necessarily come across as that guy, but, you know, maybe after a year in England, settled into the club, a bit more comfortable with the language, et cetera, maybe he could be, you know, that kind of a character. Tomiyasu, I'm quite curious because we didn't talk about this because transfer window closed on Tuesday, obviously, and we did the podcast on Monday. I'm curious, you know, what your sort of broad thoughts on him as a player. Mikel Arteta talked about how he's a versatile defender. I've had some messages from people who say he's a centre half, really, much more than a right back, even though he has played there. I mean, do you think that versatility is a good thing? Do you think we could have done with a more specialist right back, perhaps? Or, you know, do you think there's something going on in terms of this profile of player coming in that might speak to the way that we're going to set up the team this season?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, he's played a lot of different roles. He's played, you know, right side of three centre-backs. He's played left centre-back in a 4-4-2. Mm. He's played left-back briefly. He has played right-back a lot. I don't think it's the case that we've got, you know, Johan Juru filling in at right back a couple of games. The season before last, he was Bologna's right back consistently. Last season, he played a bit more at centre half. I think that is generally quite a valuable trait to have. I think, especially if there might be times of the season when the system shifts. I also think, you know, Pablo Maris looks so bad at left-sided centre-half that bringing in a defender who can potentially do that job, if required, isn't the worst thing in the world. Maybe in the future we do add another right-back and Tomiyasu ends up being counted more as one of our four centre-halves. I wouldn't preclude that possibility. But what we know about Arteta and the way his team plays, the shape and the system they play with, I think he is a sort of a decent fit for a right back in Arteta's system. And I've heard some people say, well, what if we change manager? Well, then Tomiyasu probably, if they want to go with a more overlapping attacking right back, then you count him as one of your centre halves. And he's still a really good, promising young defender. I don't think that's a disaster. But I think he will play right back for Arteta. And I think that might start as soon as Saturday. I hope it does. And I'm really intrigued to see how he gets on. I mean, he's had a really interesting journey, you know, coming out of Japanese football via Belgium into Serie A, which is sort of, you know, a pretty good schooling for any young defender. And now to England. It sounds like he's got, you know, great attitude, tremendous work ethic, plenty of ability off 2 feet. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing him.
Yeah.
What are your sort of general thoughts about the signing?
Surprising because, you know, I hadn't really heard a great deal about him. I like the fact that he gives us a bit of presence in that area of the pitch.
6 foot two.
Six foot two. So, you know, while I do think the Ben White thing is a bit overblown, I do think he is somebody who can add something in that area of the pitch. We're not the biggest team in the world either, so having somebody with a bit of presence from set pieces, etc., is good. He looks a very tidy footballer, good with both feet, and I think that's one of the interesting things that I've noticed about him and Ben White. Both of them can switch the play quite well with their wrong foot, with their left foot, so... I think that's an interesting aspect to him. Looks good on the ball. I'm looking forward to seeing him play. He's new. He gives us something different on that right hand side. You know, he's not Cedric. He's not Callum Chambers. Although I think he's maybe closer in profile to a Callum Chambers than a Cedric, if you like that kind of traditional right back.
I also think, just on that, by the way, you know, I know a lot of supporters, certainly from sort of my social media interactions, were kind of hoping we might get a kind of right-sided Kieran Tierney. And I think there's, a bit of concern that Tommy Asty might not bring that. One thing I wanted to just point out is that I think there's a very good case that the best right-back that we've seen at Arsenal this side of the millennium was Bakary Sagna.
Yeah.
And Bakary Sagna was by no means a great attacking player, but he was a fantastic defender. And I do wonder if, you know, sometimes we... I mean, I know the trend has changed regarding fullbacks and the nature of the position has changed, but there's something to be said for having a guy who is a defender first. And it looks like that's what we have in Tommy Asu. Who knows if he'll be as good as Sagna, but Sagna was obviously outstanding, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. This is a team that could use good defenders and good defending and good defensive habits as well. And, you know, the other thing as well is that I think it was Phil Costa was saying, you know, at Bologna, he was playing a very specific role there. Like, you know, they're not an open, expansive attacking team.
No.
I mean, in fairness, neither are we right now.
it's match made in heaven. Yeah.
But we're hoping, you know, that that's something that we can become. So, you know, if he is given a bit more freedom of expression, maybe it's a case that he can do more in the final third than he has done at Bologna, you know, because people will look at, well, what are his final third stats? But when you're playing in a team that demands you play in a specific way, or famously, wasn't it, Mourinho didn't want his fullbacks going over the halfway line at times, such was the way he instructed them to play within his system. So, you know, you could look at those aspects of it as well. So, look, I think he's an exciting, interesting signing, like pretty much all the ones that we've made this summer, because of their youth, because of what we can project onto them. And I hope
hate them because they didn't used to play for Chelsea.
Yeah, they've never done anything to hurt us or disappoint us.
Yeah, they arrive without stigma in most cases. Anyway, your question.
My question. Okay, here's one from D. Smith on the Discord. He said, this is going to be a weird question, but in business, when a project is in process, there are leading indicators that you can assess during the process to figure out if things are working without having to wait until the final results. Arsenal are apparently embarking on a project of youth and squad building, what are the indicators beyond results that you'll be looking for over the next few months?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, obviously, within football, results do kind of provide a lot of those indicators. Yeah. But what are the indicators beyond results? I think one thing that a lot of people would say is kind of cohesion and style. That, you know, some sense of a team identity being born. And I actually mean that in a tactical sense. But I think I also mean it in a kind of very... soft factory sense too. You know, I think if we see a group emerging and different leaders within that group, I think that will be encouraging in its own way. If we can see kind of an evolution in the squad.
Mm.
Indicators beyond that, I think you're just looking for improvement from those young players. I think you're looking to see, is this undoubtedly talented group getting better under this coach?
Mm.
are they on the right path? Are they on a positive trajectory? And even if the results aren't what we might like, I think those indicators will give the people behind the project some faith and conviction that it's worth persisting with. Is there anything else that I'm not thinking of?
I guess it's
new kits, really nice new kits. Yeah, as well. We don't. They're quite a big one.
Don't need any more of those. If we were as good at playing football as we were
adverts,
at fucking
Adidas adverts,
Adidas ads, and fucking kit launches, we would be fucking Champions League winners every season. But I think what you're just looking for is for what your eyes can tell you. You know, when you watch a game of football, you know, when you watch a team, when you watch a squad, you can tell if there's if things are going in the right direction. You can tell if players are working hard for each other. You can tell if there's the right kind of commitment. And, you know, on top of what you said about just general improvement, without being in any way facetious, scoring goals, getting results.
No,
one of the metrics I think that we were looking for before this season started was, you know, I think we, how many goals did we score last season? 55 or 58 in the Premier League? I mean, that's nowhere near enough. So one of the things that we were looking for this this season was, well, are we going to score more goals? Are we going to be more creative? And if you can see those things happening, and the football is better or improved or whatever it might be, those are the things that can tell you where we're going to go. 55 goals we scored last season. So... Mm. We need to be scoring more than that. So those things, you know, they're things that we can all see. We can all see with our eyes.
Well, the eye test, yeah, I think that's a big one. You know, can we see improvement that we don't have to go, you know, sifting through the most in-depth of numbers to find? You know, can we see things that are tangible signs of progress?
Exactly. We don't need to make up a new expected something metric to justify the way that we're playing. You know what I mean? And that's not to be dismissive of stats or anything like it, but you know what I mean?
No, exactly. We don't need to kind of construct these quite complicated arguments to justify. We can just watch the team and be like, oh, that's actually a bit better.
Yeah, that's better.
That would be really nice. Yeah. That's what I would like.
A bit more of that.
Yeah. Here's a good question. Golden Cannon on Twitter. What do you think of the media treatment of Arsenal? Recently, it seems they've taken joy out of our struggles, sometimes excessively so. Do you think there is an agenda there? And if so, why? We aren't dominating the league and we hardly challenge. What's going on?
Do I think? I mean, I just think we're an easy target right now. We're absolutely, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. You know, Arsenal is we're a big club and we're underperforming. Therefore, you're going to get it in the neck. And I think what's interesting, I might have said this before, is that I feel like nowadays, and I don't just mean this about Arsenal fans, I think football fans or fans of a specific club are super, super informed about what's going on at their clubs. Because... there are blogs, there are podcasts, there are YouTube channels. Every aspect of the club is covered from top to bottom. And if you want to read everything, you can do that. You can know everything there is to know about a football club. And I think what happens is, if you're Johnny Pundit, you can't be as granular with your knowledge. Mm-hmm. Like Jamie Carragher might know about Liverpool and Gary Neville might know about Man United and Jamie Redknapp might know about fucking... that bunch of cunts that he used to play for. You know what I mean? But your average guy, your average pundit, your average journalist, and again, this is not to be critical, cannot understand a football club to the level that a fan can if the fan is invested in knowing about their football club, right? So they might say something, which is their personal opinion, whatever it might be, but... it might not make any sense because the fan or the fans know something different. Mm-hmm. Like Gary Neville last week saying, I don't really know what Arsenal's transfer strategy is a bit...
great example, yeah.
A bit stupid because even with peripheral knowledge of of Arsenal this summer, like I'd say most football fans could say, hey, look, they're buying players who are like 21, 22, 23. All the players they've been linked with are like 21, 22, 23. So, yeah, I wonder what their strategy could be. Hang on, I'll see if I can work this one out. Oh, I've got it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think some of it is just a bit daft. Some of it is I'm going to say ignorance, but that's not – it sounds like a strong word, right? When you say –
You just mean that it's not their
– they're not specialized in Arsenal, whereas we all are. We know
– They don't know the context.
Exactly.
Well.
That's it. So I don't necessarily think there is a bias. I think there are obviously some pundits out there and some journalists out there who have leanings, who may or may not like Arsenal, who see this as an opportunity to be a bit snide and put the boot in. But, you know, at the end of the day, if we were winning and we were top of the league, A, we wouldn't give a fish's tit what any of them were saying about anything. And B, we wouldn't be the target. It'd be whoever else is underperforming. Whether it was, you know, Chelsea in that season where they finished 12th or whatever it was when Mourinho got sacked. I mean, they must have got a hard time in the media. I didn't pay any attention because I was too busy just not giving a shit about Chelsea. But I'd say it's just something that we feel a bit more acutely right now because of what's going on. And it's because what's been going on of late has just not been good enough. So the simple solution is to make things better, is to improve. And then you don't give anyone the opportunity to talk about you in a way that you don't like. The other option, of course, is just, you know, use your off button. Don't click the link, you know.
And the other thing I would say is that maybe, you know, as Arsenal fans, we should be worried when people aren't talking about the club in this way. You know, I think the fact is it is a really big club and we are in pretty dire straits in terms of our league position. And whenever that's the case, you're going to have a target on your back. It's the disparity between sort of where we should be and where we are that creates all that conversation. So at least I think it indicates that people think of Arsenal as a big club still, you know, even though our results undercut that substantially. I don't think there's a particular bias. I think, like you, we're just an easy target. We're there to be had. You know, it's interesting, and results influence that. When you're losing games, you get stories around clubs that you just probably wouldn't get, or they generate traction that they wouldn't get if you were winning or if you're top of the league.
Yeah.
Everything becomes a stick to beat the club with.
It's,
you know,
it's easy to believe the worst when things are going badly. You know, and it's just, and look, I think as well, it is easy for people to have a go because you can say anything right now about Arsenal, any kind of criticism, and it will ring true for somebody at least because of everything, you know?
So, yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I felt that a little bit with the Maitland-Niles one that was going on over deadline day where, you know, ultimately Arsenal rejected a loan offer from Everton. And I think if Arsenal were winning games and we trusted Edu and Arteta and we thought they were competent people, as a fan base, we probably would have been like, well, yeah, hold out for a better loan fee or more money. But because there isn't that trust and we're in crisis and we're in disarray, you know, it all becomes framed as calamity and incompetence and, you know, it's just an interesting, the context is everything, you know, and when the club aren't winning, they're going to be slaughtered. And I think we have to accept that, you know, that's the pressure of being a big club. That's the pressure of sport. You have to deliver. And I think, I hope, the other thing is that as long as there's, it's important that Edu's come out and spoken, because as long as there is a gap which we can fill with, well, maybe these people are incompetent, or other people outside the club who aren't fans, or people who are journalists, or other media. As long as that gap's there, there's always going to be an issue. Whereas at least now the club have said, this is what we're doing, and you can critique it and you can think it's bad, but you can't think it's just chaos, at least. And I think that helps, actually, and that will kind of control that narrative a little. You know, Gary Neville, he can't say what he said a week ago now. He can say, I don't think it's a good idea, but he can't say, I don't know what they're doing.
I mean, even a cursory look at what we were doing would tell you what we were doing.
I mean, to be honest, yes, I think he should have been able to get there anyway, but I think at least there is that absolute clarity now. By the way, there was another question about media that I thought was very interesting. Danny Dimovsky said, thoughts on Emi Martinez constantly bringing up Arsenal every time he talks to the media. It's almost like a bitter obsession or a grudge. And there were a few questions like this. I don't know what he's actually said, Emi. I don't know either.
I mean, I saw...
They kept me in a prison, the gilded cage of London Colony. You know, Jerry Payton used to burn my feet with hot coals. And I don't know what he said.
Go on. Well, we'd one on the Discord from David the Sky, who said, how concerned are you by the rumours that Emi Martinez is going to talk about Arsenal on his deathbed? So I feel like I've kind of missed out something, but I'm guessing it was, you know, an interview. He does seem to be talking about us a lot for a guy, well, you know, who left a year ago at this point. You know, whatever about having a, you know, an interview when you first leave, to be still talking about it, you know, I don't know.
Let me just see what he's actually said. He said that Arsenal did not understand. It's something about international duty. Oh, I've got no idea. But basically, what I was going to say was it may not be Emi's fault because we are a magnet for... because we are such an easy target, and the Martinez story is another stick to beat the club with, you know, the fact that he left and we sold him and he's gone on and done so well. You know, ultimately, it's journalists who are asking him these questions. It's people putting the name of Arsenal in front of him for him to comment on, I suspect. And, you know, they're thinking, well, if I can get him to say something about Arsenal, that's going to generate headlines. It's going to generate clicks.
Maybe that's it. You know,
I don't know. I don't know for a fact that that's what's happening, but I do wonder. You know, we are Arsenal are just such a we're box office. We may not be good, but we're box office.
Speaking of goalkeepers, we have a question from Roy Habib, who's at Oi35. He says, I remember when Petr Cech almost passed the ball into his own goal. Leno's previous team were tweeting that he was a modern keeper with the capability of playing the ball with his feet. Now he's considered not good enough to play from the back. Thoughts? And then there's a follow-up question, or a different question, from Josh, who's at JoshRobinson87, who says, who are you picking in goal against Norwich, Leno or Ramsdale?
Yeah, I really like this question from George Stevens, who just said, true or false, Aaron Ramsdale? Which, that was the whole question. I think...
True. He is Aaron Ramsdale.
He is a true man. Yeah, I think it's an interesting point about the Leno... You know, was it Schalke saying, oh, they've got a good goalkeeper who can play with his feet?
Leverkusen.
Right, yeah. That's an interesting point, isn't it? Has playing out from the back evolved so dramatically in the space of
3 years
that Leno has been left behind by the pace of change? I suspect not. I suspect that playing out from the back is only 50% about actual technical ability and kicking the ball. I suspect that a huge percentage of it is psychological and tactical. So understanding when you should do it and when not, following the patterns, and also having the conviction, shall we say, the confidence to follow through on that. I think that I doubt very much there is a great deal between how well Leno and Ramsdale can strike a ball on the training ground. I'd be surprised if there's a gulf in quality because, you know, partly because of what we're seeing about Leverkusen saying he could do it in Germany and these kinds of things. I just wonder if it's that second part where Leno is struggling at the moment and where Ramsdale, maybe with the confidence of youth, may be less inhibited. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I said
this
last week.
Do you think that's right?
Maybe. I think there is certainly... there's certainly
an element
of
component.
Of course. Of course. And look, you know, when you're comparing Petr Cech with the ball at his feet and Bernd Leno with the ball at his feet, you know, Cech looked like he was wearing clown shoes in comparison
to Leno.
It's
the evolution of man diagram, isn't it? You know, we're hoping that Ramsdale's like the... Ramsdale can walk upright and everything.
Wow. Yeah, I know what you mean. But
Ospina is there, hunched over.
Little Al Mooney, a fish coming out of the sea. yeah.
Please make that, someone. Please do that on Photoshop. I'd really enjoy it.
Oh, my God, that would be amazing. I think there's a confidence element in it for sure. For sure. Yeah. And for whatever reason, whether it's in himself and maybe in some part the players in front of him, like, I don't think Leno has helped a couple of the guys with some of his passes. Yeah. Nevertheless.
He's not had Ben White to give it to, really.
No, but like, I mean, if you're Bernd Leno, how many times can you give the pass to Granit Xhaka and see him get pickpocketed from behind without suffering some kind of residual traumatic stress disorder from that very incident? Here's Xhaka going, give me the ball, give me the ball. Are you sure? Okay, I'll give you the ball. And Xhaka, you know, doesn't spot the eight players congregating around him, all coming from different angles, like fighter pilots to his slow-moving fucking aircraft carrier, you know. So maybe there's an element of that, but it does feel a bit like we have gone way too far away from what Mikel Arteta wants from his goalkeeper. So whether Leno can get it back or whether... Ramsdale comes in, I don't quite know, but I mean, what would you do? What do you think Mikel Arteta, because what we would do is neither here nor there, but what do you think Mikel Arteta will do for Norwich?
I think it's a really tricky one, actually. You know, I think it's quite finely balanced. I think that, you know, Ramsdale played, of course, in the behind closed door game, and they'll have had another look at him there. I think he's got a chance for Saturday. I guess it's because we've had the break and it's like potentially, you know, we spoke about wanting to get those signings in the team and have a fresh look about it. I think that could go in his favour, but, you know, Leno's going to come back from international duty and they'll have a decision to make. If I had to put money on it, I think he'll stick with Leno just about. But I think we're close to a change. I think we're not far off.
I think if you do it this early in the season to Leno after like a couple of defeats where I don't think you can really put much of it on the goalkeeper himself. I don't think he was particularly great in the Brentford game. To be honest, that second goal didn't really reflect well on him. And I know there was criticism of him for the first goal against Man City where he looked like he was going to come and then didn't.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can really blame a goalkeeper for defeats against Chelsea and Man City. And it feels like you kind of...
He made good saves in both those games.
Yeah, he did. And you're kind of crossing the Rubicon a little, aren't you, if you make that change this early? Like... Basically, you're saying the baton has been passed. You are now going to sit for an entire season. Does that then not create the competitive environment that you want? Like, you want Ramsdale really pushing Leno. That's what you want. Whereas if you give it to Ramsdale right now, like, is... And this isn't to sort of... besmirch Leno or his professionalism or anything like that, but is he going to be motivated to win his place back, or is he just going to go, well, I'm going to go next summer anyway, fuck it?
Yeah, it might be a bit much, might it, the week after the transfer deadline to go, oh, by the way, you're out.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think there's any way, It's something Manchester United did a bit last season, and I don't have the numbers on this, so someone would need to check, and I'll be honest, I'm not going to. But I think they occasionally would leave David De Gea out in the league to give a game, like two or three times in the course of the Premier League season, they gave a game to... who's the young fellow?
Henderson?
The guy they got, Dean Henderson, yeah. So I think, like, it wasn't that De Gea was dropped. It was just, we've got two goalkeepers and we rotate one in here and there. Do you think Arsenal will do that at any point? Like, is there the possibility that you could think, well, this is a good game to give Ramsdale a league debut? We'll do it. It doesn't mean Leno's out in the cold. It's just...
sort of competition and keeping one on their toes. I guess it depends how confident you are in making that decision, and does it have an impact on the team and the way that it plays? Like, if Ramsdale comes in and is, like, knocking it about at the back, like, fucking...
Sure. Cesc Fabregas through balls.
Exactly. You know, he's...
Rabonas, yeah.
He's doing all that, and then you bring in Leno, who's just going to clump it downfield. You know, but this... I think this all comes back to what we want from the team in terms of how it plays and how it improves. You know, it ties into that. Like, the style of play, so to speak, is not going to win too many awards right now, is it? You know, so we need to be playing better football. So maybe that in some way informs your decision about the goalkeeper as well. If you think they're both good shot stoppers, but you think one is better at, you know, distributing the ball from the back, or keeping the ball at the back, or doesn't put his defenders under as much pressure, that could be the key factor. That could be the key factor, but I do think it's probably still a little bit too early. So,
yeah, I think that it's not impossible, given, you know, we don't have European football, that there might be games where Ramsdale sort of gets a go in the Premier League as a kind of test that doesn't necessarily mean Leno's out in the cold. I think it will be Leno for now. I think you've got to give him the chance with better players in front of him. I mean, look, he can't give it to Kolasinac short. Do you know what I mean? I'm not joking. Like, he can't. You know, it's not a serious option. Like, if you give him a back four of Tomiyasu, White, Gabriel, Tierney, and he's still kicking it 70 yards at Bukayo Saka's head, because he scored one header for England, then maybe we have to change it.
Yes.
I think Leno's probably not quite, you know, done enough to deserve being dropped.
I think that's fair.
But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I do think there is a call there. I'm sure it'll be a discussion at the training ground. What about this? BH14, I think his name is Ben, said, what happens to Nketiah and Balogun now? I don't realistically see them getting much game time. And is this an indictment on Edu's youthful core philosophy? Our growing inability to manage talent already at the club is a big concern.
Great question. And I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I really feel, and I think you said it last week, that you really wanted Eddie to leave.
To get his move,
just because he needs to play. He is now in an awkward position, because maybe some of the minutes that we thought we might be able to give to Balogun, Nketiah is kind of he's more experienced, but he's going to leave in a year or less than a year. You know, do you completely sideline him? I mean, what's the point in giving Eddie minutes that you could give to Balogun? They're much more beneficial to Arsenal, or it is more beneficial to Arsenal for Balogun to get minutes than it is for Nketiah to get minutes, if you think that they are, you know, more or less the same in terms of talent. Like, if Nketiah was miles, miles better than Balogun, you'd say, well, you know, to get the results, we can play Eddie, even if he is going to leave. But I don't think that's the case. That's the dynamic. Is that your dog?
Yeah, I better go and just calm her down. She's on her own in the living room, and she seems to be very sad about that.
She does.
Give me 1 minute and I'll come back.
Yeah, no problem.
Great. Bow. Come on.
I'm doing a podcast.
I've explained to Belle that I'm doing a podcast.
I heard you explain that.
You can leave that in. You can leave that in. I've reasoned with her. If that doesn't work, I don't know what will.
That's what dogs react to best. It's just rational explanation in a language they don't understand.
Listen, I understand. You're stressed. You're lonely. You're sad. I am doing a podcast, okay? You should subscribe, by the way. You're supposed to be an Arsenal fan.
Yeah.
What were we saying?
We're talking about Nketiah and Balogun.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Like, so Eddie Nketiah's got a year to run. My understanding is that if he leaves for nothing, or if he leaves on a free transfer at the end of that, Arsenal will be due compensation. It's not quite the case that they get nothing.
If he goes to another English club. I don't know if that's the case if he goes to...
I think that's right. Training compensation for a move to a British club. So he's in a real kind of strange no man's land. The only thing that makes me think he'll be okay is that Mikel Arteta has been consistently very positive about Eddie Nketiah. And I'm not sure I necessarily see that changing. I think he... But even so, without European football... When's he going to play? I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Lacazette. You know, they're talking about Lacazette as one of these five important players. Is he going to play a lot? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, it was always difficult to see where Balogun was going to get minutes if Lacazette stayed in particular, because we've only got 38 games. So barring an injury problem or, you know, something else, suspensions or whatever it might be. I mean, as you saw on the opening day of the season, he started because neither Aubameyang or Lacazette were available because they had COVID. Yeah. So,
And maybe that situation influenced plans a little bit. I don't know. But I don't get that impression. I mean, Balogun should be out on loan, really.
I think so, yeah. I think I'm surprised that that didn't happen in the outgoing part of the window.
I mean, he didn't even start against West Brom.
Yeah, and your point earlier about Tammy Abraham.
Yeah.
Where did he go? He went to Bristol Rovers. He went to West Brom, was it?
Aston Villa
when they were in the championship. Yeah. So, you know, he went and played full seasons at decent clubs and scored a lot of goals. Those goals got him his chance at Chelsea. And ultimately, those goals got him his move to Roma. So,
yeah,
it is a strange one for Balogun because I don't know how much he is going to play if Aubameyang stays fit and scores goals. So,
no, I agree. And, you know, people sort of scoffed. Sheffield United paid a lot of money for Rian Brewster. I don't know if you remember from Liverpool, and he didn't get a goal for them in the Premier League last season. They paid £23 million, something like that. But the reason they did that is that Brewster had gone out on loan to Swansea and been really, really impressive for them. I think he scored, here you go, 11 in 22 at Swansea in the Championship.
Can I ask you a question? I don't know if you know or not, but we do have a loan manager.
Ben Napper.
At the club. So that's his entire job. But is his role specific to keeping tabs on the players that we have out on loan? Or is he in any way involved in trying to find clubs for players we are looking to loan out?
He is. He is. And he's about, you know... All that stuff you hear about trying to find the right stylistic match and things like that, you know, that would come under his remit, certainly. I think in the case of Balogun, there's never been any indication for the club that he was available for loan. They've said since he signed the contract, they'd see him as a big part of plans for going to be with the first team. He got his promotion, got his squad number, all that stuff. But just looking at it from where I'm stood, I don't see, especially with Nketiah there, how he's going to get enough game time to really push on. He's too good for under 23 football at this point.
And they've brought in a kid, haven't they? The young lad from Fulham, who was in the under 23 team because Balogun has made the step up to the first team. So, look, I'd like to see him get more minutes and get some playing time for us. And, you know, if we're, you know, imagine a crazy, crazy scenario where we're winning comfortably against Norwich on Saturday or Sunday?
Saturday.
Saturday.
I think, Andrew, it's a Saturday 3 p.m. kickoff.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
That is streaming territory, of course. But, you know, if we're in a situation where we're a few goals up and, you know, you want to give a young player some minutes, that's the ideal scenario. So if that's the situation, let's imagine we've got on the bench Lacazette, Balogun is on the bench, because you can have 9 subs now. Mm. Like, where do you want to see those minutes go?
I want to see them go to Balogun, certainly. Yeah.
Like, you don't want to see him... So, with all due respect to Eddie, if he's not going to be around, we have to make the investment in the players who are. So, I don't want to see Lacazette, because we've seen him and we know what he can do and can't do. And he's going to leave next summer. So, in situations like this, I think this is going to be an interesting aspect of Mikel Arteta's management. I know he has to play this game, this balancing game where, like, if Lacazette keeps getting passed over as a substitute for Balogun, he's not going to be happy. And senior players, when they're not happy, can be problematic. So he does have to try and strike a balance in terms of keeping people happy, because that's part and parcel of the job, whether people like it or not. But I want to see Balogun get the minutes, because that is an investment in a player who's 20 years of age. We've given him a new contract. We obviously believe in his potential and his talent. And... give him those minutes. Don't give them to Eddie. Again, though, you could make a case that if we're going to try and sell Eddie or loan him or whatever, maybe it's a bit too late for that now, but, you know, some shop window football for Eddie, who looked quite sharp in preseason, in fairness.
Yeah, he did.
You know, but this is what we've got to do to try and build for the future, but...
Yeah, I mean, and in fairness to the club, what they tried to do with Eddie, which is basically what they've done with Reece Nelson, you know, the 1 year extension plus a loan somewhere that could have increased his value, it's not in itself a bad idea. It's just that he wasn't up for that at this point. And I think, you know, the time for that was probably last summer or even the previous January transfer window. And that ship seems to have sailed.
We did talk about this at the time, where that situation with Balogun, when it looked like his contract was going to run down. Balogun and Nketiah have the same agent. Mm-hmm. So in order to get Balogun to sign a new contract, we've obviously had to give him and that agent some assurances about playing time or how he's viewed, his development, what the plan is for him. And it strikes me that the detail of that is probably at odds with Eddie Nketiah's existence, if you like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And therefore, it becomes very difficult to convince Nketiah to sign a loan or sign a contract extension so he can loan him out, because he already knows. He already knows that, like, his race is run, maybe, at Arsenal. And maybe we're premature. Yeah. Who knows what might happen, but...
Yeah, I mean, stranger things. But, you know, he's 22 now. He's not going to play a vast amount of football between now and January, unless something quite extraordinary happens. And, yeah, I feel for him. I mean, he could still go... Some transfer windows are still open, aren't they? Isn't there the Turkish window still open? There's stories about Mohamed Elneny have been floating around.
I can't. Well, he got injured, so he's not going to go. And I just can't see Eddie going to Turkey on loan or permanently or anything like that. So, okay. I think we'll do one more very quick one, if I can find it here. It comes from George C., who's at G-Man Sizzle. He says, it's been about 15 years since the Arsenalization of the stadium. The latest players to feature on the montage wrapped around the ground are Henri and Perez. Which players who played for the club after 2006 would you add to the list, and why?
Wow. Henri and Perez. Since 2006, Aaron Ramsey, I would have.
Is he not up there, actually? Was there not, like... Or was that an advertising kit thing?
I'm not sure, but I mean, his involvement in several iconic moments
is
enough to give him... The problem is a lot of the big names that you immediately think of, their association with the club is a little bit tarnished in some way, shape or form. Robin Van Persie, of course, would be one. Mesut Ozil, Alexis Sanchez. None of them quite left on good terms, shall we say, which makes it very difficult.
Santi Cazorla?
Yes, I think he would be a... someone everyone could agree on. I mean, it's. I think it's a terrible shame that someone like Lauren Koscielny left on bad terms.
Yeah, I agree.
Fantastic.
I agree.
Bakary Sagna was fantastic as well.
But even he got grief.
Did he? When he went to City?
Yeah.
I forget now.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he didn't sign a new deal, right? He left for nothing. It seems weird to not include Cedric after the brace against Brentford in the behind closed doors friendly.
Well, if you're having Cedric, we've got to have Shamak.
Yeah, we could give them just statues, I suppose. You know? They're the next obvious choice. I think...
Inflatable statues.
Deflatable, crucially. I think Ramsey is the one that I feel most comfortable with. What about you?
I think I agree with Ramsey. I think Santi Cazorla would be... a widely accepted addition, if such a thing were being made. Beyond that, it's hard, though. Like, Per Mertesacker, but you can't really do it when someone's a staff member, I guess.
No.
Thomas Eisfeld?
Would be very divisive right now. Thomas Eisfeld, of course.
Ice, baby.
I mean, they're not going to do Ozil, are they?
No.
With all that water under the bridge.
The Jeff.
I mean, Alexis was, I think, comfortably, for me, like the best player I've seen in that period. I mean, it, you know, at his best, he was sensational.
So you're talking about the post-2011 period rather than 2006.
So.
Yeah. No, I agree. And a phenomenal force of nature talent that... I really feel we should have... I don't want to talk about the summer of 2015 again. It just depressed me, so I won't. But yeah, it was just sensational. And you know what he was as well? He was fun. He was just fucking fun to watch. I know he drove everyone mad in the end. I think including some of his teammates. And clearly, it did not end well. I don't think it was an end that we covered ourselves in glory in either. Alexis was difficult towards the end, but I don't think Arsenal handled that situation very well. But what a fun player. He was just capable of moments in games through the way that he played, the way he would just keep trying, and he had the quality to kind of back that up. You know what I mean? It was great.
Despite that, I would sort of say I'm not sure that there existed between him and the Arsenal fans the kind of connection that certain players have. I don't know if there was always a slight sense that maybe he was kind of passing through, or maybe he just wasn't here long enough. But
he was here 3.5 years.
Yeah.
So it was long enough. I just think in terms of his kind of personality, I don't know that he was, like, Santi as a character, for example, was very easy to warm to because he had that lovable, kind of personality, very lovable, just infectious, a happy guy who everybody could love. Whereas I think Alexis was very intense in his work and the way that he played, but a bit of a strange guy off the pitch, you know? And that's harder to reconcile with. And it's difficult to make that kind of a connection with people when you're, you know, he's quite happy in his own world. You know what I mean? He didn't need necessarily to have the adulation. I think some players want the adulation. He was, you know, he'd go home and play the piano to his dogs and then go running up a volcano on his holidays. And that was him. He was just happy doing that. He didn't need to be.
And he lived in the woods. And he ate raw flesh.
Yeah.
And that was Alexis.
That was Alexis.
But that was just Alexis.
He dig a lair, a den.
And he, with his bare hands.
And
yeah.
he burrow through the woods and forage on nuts and berries and things yeah. like that. That
he'd was, appear at London Colney through the ground. He'd like his underground network would come up through the fence. Arson used to go crazy because he ruined the training pitches.
Fucking pristine pitches and
all,
they
all these molehills created by Alexis Sanchez. But would he be an appropriate addition to the Arsenalisation? I think maybe more time would have to pass. I think the United thing, as much as it yeah. was very funny how bad he was for them, I think that will be...
Yeah, that ultimately, I think... It's why, you know, Cesc couldn't go. Because mm. of the Chelsea thing. You just, you know, just can't shake that off.
Tricky.
Yeah. All right, look, will we leave it there? I think we should leave it there.
Let's leave it there. Yeah, yeah. For an interlude.
For an interlude, we've fucking done ourselves justice here, I think. So, look, as ever, thank you for listening. Thanks for being here. Later on in the week, we will, of course, have a regular Arsecast. We'll have stuff on Patreon during the week as well. We're going to do something with Lewis also. Patreon.com/ArseBlog. We'll do the waffle on Wednesday. And for now, enjoy the weather. I'm going out to enjoy some of the weather as soon as I get this done. And we'll catch you on the next one.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bye-bye.